This is Cultivating Place, conversations on natural history and the human impulse to garden. From North State Public Radio in Northern California, I'm Jennifer Jewell. It makes sense if you think about it even momentarily. Plants, landscapes, gardens, they begin with seed and they end with seed. Seeds are the alpha and omega of the plant world. The seed stage of the life cycle is the only time in a plant's life when it is fully mobile and when all of its genetic material and instructions are in one ingenious little travel pack ready and waiting for the right conditions to germinate the next cycle. If you think about this even momentarily, the importance of seed starts to become clear. With the consolidation of individual seed growers into multinational corporations, fewer and fewer seed sources and seed varieties are available to the standard market buyer. Combine that with the advent in the last 75 years of seed law, seed patents, and genetic modification of seed, and the state of the world's seed bank for habitat, for food, for utility, for beauty, for the genetic diversity of the future is in flux. Today on Cultivating Place, we kick off a mini seed series of conversations. Think of it as Seedy September. We start by speaking with Jerry Gettle, whose name you may recognize as the heart and head behind Baker Creek Seeds and the founding organizer of the upcoming International Heirloom Expo in Santa Rosa, California, September 11th through the 13th. Toward the second half of the program, we revisit a conversation with Michaela Cawley, past executive director of the Organic Seed Alliance based in Port Townsend, Washington, about the organic seed movement and industry. Finally, we wrap up with Kaylin Redwood, co-owner farmer with her husband Cam of Redwood Seeds, a 40-acre organic seed farm nestled in the foothills of Northern California and cultivating more than 230 seed crops for the diversity of climates in this region. And now to our conversation with Jerry, who joins us via Skype from Baker Creek Seeds in Mansfield, Missouri. Welcome, Jerry.
Sure, appreciate it. Good to be here.
So I want to start with, I want to ultimately get into the very exciting and upcoming Heirloom Expo taking place in Santa Rosa in September. But I want to start a little further back from that, Jerry, and have you tell us a little bit about the history of Baker Creek Seeds and its heirloom beginnings, starting with you as a very little boy in a vegetable patch of your parents and your grandparents and your own sort of seed origins.
Yeah, well, to start with, I guess I grew up in a family in the Boise Valley area of Idaho and actually Oregon, right on the Oregon border. And all my family, when I was small, lived in the area, and all my family pretty much grew a garden, you know, of some sort. Mm. And so as a small child, I remember when I was, you know, 2, 3, 4 years old, up till I was about 5 years old, we lived in that valley, and my memories were all pretty much outdoors, doing things outdoors, whether it was picking mushrooms or harvesting wild asparagus, or you know, more particularly growing things. I grew things with my grandmothers, both my grandmothers, one with from a Danish-German background, and then also my Mexican grandmother, and they gardened together often as well. Mm. So I grew all sorts of different vegetables, not necessarily just things that are common, you know, on the American's table, but things that might have been either popular in their cultures or things that they just found in a catalog somewhere, things they all were always experimenting. And my folks were always experimenting. My mom and dad grew like up to an acre or so of vegetables and then all sorts of different fruits and flowers. So I pretty much grew up growing a little bit of everything. And my earliest memories of gardening, my own garden I grew when I was 3 years old was growing little the scallop squash, or sometimes called patty pan squash, mm-hmm. then also the little yellow pear tomatoes. And from that little garden and gardening with my aunts and uncles and grandparents and parents, basically is where I kind of got the idea to, you know, I knew right from the start that someday I wanted to work with seeds. It was always, even as a small child, I would look through the seed catalogs and dream, you know, of someday working at a seed company somewhere.
Yeah. And there is that wonderful, really almost iconic photo now that I've seen in talks you've given, in workshops you've led, of you as a little thing, maybe three, sitting in just a big bunch of harvested gourds and pumpkins and other vegetables in the fall, all bundled up against the chill. And by the time you were 16, you were a member of Seed Savers Exchange. Talk about this kind of trajectory into saving and swapping seeds, which has such a great history.
Yeah, well, I guess where I started getting interested in preserving the older varieties, I started noticing in the catalogs of the day, I started, you know, when I was small, I noticed things, as I got a little older each year, things would disappear out of the seed catalogs. Mm-hmm. At the same time, there was starting to be a movement among smaller seed companies, and they were starting to release things called heirloom seeds. And so about that time, I noticed things disappearing, and noticed other catalogs and other people starting to talk about, you know, saving seed, preserving the older varieties. And I was definitely interested, so I started requesting every seed catalog I could, gathering information. And in that process, you know, over the years, I started hearing about Seed Savers Exchange. I started really requesting seed catalogs when I was 9 and 10 years old. But by the time I became about 15, 16 years old, I joined Seed Savers. And from there, it really opened up to my eyes how much diversity actually there was. You know, I knew a little bit from all the different catalogs, but when I got the Seed Saver yearbook and started going through and trading seeds with all the members and writing to the different members in various different countries and seeing all the things that were happening globally with seeds, both their disappearance and also the people that were saving the old varieties, mm-hmm. was just really inspiring and really got me thinking, you know, hey, I need to do something to help save these old varieties, whether it's commercial or whether it's just a hobby. At that time, I didn't really know. I was hoping, you know, someday I could do a full-time work with seeds, because, you know, most people that do it as a hobby, they really, it's challenging to get, you know, enough time to do really what you want to in the garden every day. It's so neat out there. And that's a continual challenge, even when you run a seed company, but at least every day I'm around the plants and working with the plants in some form or another.
Yeah. And your first catalog that you put together, and I think just had 500 copies. Talk about the beginnings of your seed business at that point.
After a couple of years in Seed Savers Exchange, you know, selling seeds and trading seeds with different members, I thought I might as well try it. I always wanted to try to do a catalog of some sort. I've been dreaming of it for years. So I thought I'd print a little 12-page price list of different things I'd saved out of the garden and that I'd been offering to people in Seed Savers Exchange and just see what happened. And that first catalog went out to about 500 or so different customers, mostly in Missouri and a few surrounding states like Illinois. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I made about probably $1,100 or $1,200 that year. I definitely knew it wasn't going to be a business at that point, but it was still, a really fun experience to connect to all these different gardeners, you know, several hundred gardeners that first year. And then the following year, 1999, was right before, of course, the year Y2K or year 2000, and everybody was concerned about whether their food supply was secure. So everybody was looking for heirloom seeds. And that year, our sales went up about 40%. And then I started to see, you know, the potential. Maybe this can become a business. Mm-hmm. And also the interest in non-GMO and organic and alternative forms of agriculture, small agriculture, all these different words and terms were becoming more and more in use. And, you know, heirloom was just becoming on our consciousness nationally about that time. You know, in the mid to late 90s, people were really starting to, you know, people like Mr. Rogers went and covered stories about growing heirloom vegetables in school gardens. And, you know, people like Martha Stewart were showing them on her show and in her magazine. So it was really a big change in that late 90s to early 2000s from, you know, everything being hybrids on the dinner table and in the restaurants. And that's really what I think that we kind of rode that little bit of a crest of interest in traditional varieties.
Well, and you not only rode it, I would say that is humility speaking. You also really have helped to inspire and encourage it. And so describe for listeners who may not be familiar, describe for them what the catalog looks like now, how many varieties are there, how many continents and countries they represent, and how many catalogs you send out each year.
So yeah, as far as what's represented in the catalog, it's basically a rainbow of color, of varieties. Like in front of me here, I'm looking at jalapeno peppers right now as I'm working on the next year's catalog, actually, as we speak. And I'm looking at four different colors of jalapenos, for example.
Mm-hmm.
All these different vegetables that we know of, like this year we're also introducing pink celery. So basically we're representing varieties from about 100 different countries or so. And it's almost about the same every year we sell to, maybe about 80 different countries every year our seeds go to. So, you know, all of the U.S., of course, but then also, you know, customers from China to Japan and England to Australia. And, you know, it's really a broad range of countries where people are interested in these old varieties.
Mm-hmm.
And our collection every year, you know, we keep finding new things. I mean, we didn't even know a really true pink celery existed. We were just familiar with what's offered in the U.S., which is kind of a reddish, there's a few reddish colored celeries, but nothing's really true pink. So, you know, this last year we were able to find a true pink variety in China. Or, you know, that's just one example. But, you know, over the years, every year we get new surprises. You know, this mm-hmm. year we're excited about black goji berries. And it's just on and on, the different types of vegetables that are, and flowers and herbs that are just totally stunning and totally, you know, make a new class of vegetables almost, like the snake melon that we've got that we ordered this seed a long time ago when I was, you know, much younger, and I grew it. And I thought it was interesting. It was beautiful, the long, curvy-looking snake-like fruit. But this year we gave them another try, got a bunch of seed from China, and we're growing them out again this year. And we cooked them, and we were amazed. The kids love them because they actually taste just like green beans.
Mm.
So it's, you know, every year we discover something new. It's like, I should have tried that years ago. Years ago, I thought, oh, it was a neat ornamental. But this year we actually cooked them, and it's like all our kids love them. So it's, you know, a totally new class of vegetables.
Yeah.
That we can add to, you know, hopefully more Americans' diets this coming year. And that's just one example out of many every year. So.
Yeah. And how many total varieties do you offer in this year's catalog?
About 1,800 in the whole seed catalog that we put out.
Mm-hmm.
So in online, it ranges between, you know, 1,800 and 2,200, depending on the time of the year and mm-hmm. what we're able to grow from year to year.
And in terms of the number of countries that you have sourced from, I think this is one of the storylines in your work that really moves me, and I think many gardeners, is the work you have put into reaching out to other countries and cultures and communities within the U.S., but across the globe, trying to connect with people in order to save seeds. I've heard you say before that, you know, while you have this great diversity of seed you're offering, there's almost like a personal sense of urgency on your side as to how many have been lost and how many are still out there that you would like to incorporate into the saving and the recording of.
Yeah, that's one of the main things that I not only enjoy personally, but also, you know, it's just, we find so many valuable plants by traveling. Each year, you know, we probably take about, not me personally necessarily, but somebody in the company. Like right now, we have a guy in Thailand. 2 weeks ago, we had somebody in Thailand and China. A little earlier on, we were in several other countries. So it's basically a continual search for seeds in some country. More often than not, we have somebody somewhere. And our greatest, probably number one focus is throughout Asia and then Europe and South America. You know, we've been a little bit into Africa, you know, basically a little bit everywhere
mm-hmm.
looking for seeds. And and also our customers are always looking for seeds for us. So we're always getting on like a daily basis, you know, somebody saying, hey, I have my great grandmother's bean, or hey, I just took a trip to the Philippines and found a new eggplant. Would you guys be interested in trying it?
Yeah,
and a lot of times we get seeds with amazing histories. I mean, seeds that came to this country from like Japan. One, the Yokohama squash, came here in the 1860s from President Lincoln's ambassador to Japan, and they brought it here to the U.S. And it was popular in the U.S. for a short time. In a number of catalogs, disappeared. A seed saver in France had been saving it, and the French had been saving it. We got the seed about 20 years ago from the French, and we had the privilege this year of going back to Japan and handing it to a few different seed collectors there, and they hadn't seen anything like it. They think that it probably morphed or changed over the years into some of their modern day squashes, but they were, you know, kind of tickled that we brought something back to Yokohama that they had not seen, you know, at least in probably 100, well, we don't really know how long, maybe 50 or 100 years. We don't know how long it's disappeared from there. So that's the thing with seeds. There's always these stories that mm-hmm. go with them, and personal, you know, personal notes and cultures are always exchanging. It brings cultures together around these traditional varieties, which now is part of, you know, part French, part American, and, you know, originally from Japan, but all in the beginning originally came probably from Mexico. So it's, you know, it's just a continual connection between cultures and continents.
Yeah. And they really do bring people together around the seed, the story of the seed, and then the food or the plant that it comes from the seed. So one of the things you were just touching on really gets to the heart of, in terms of the seed from Japan, you being able to help reintroduce it there to some extent, gets to one of the key motivators, I think, for you, from what I understand, in terms of saving and preserving and recording genetic history and diversity.
Yeah, it's definitely one of the main things we're focusing on, is not just the, you know, where the seed's been, but also the personal stories, you know, as much as we can find personal stories, stories of, you know, where these seeds came from, and then passing the, you know, making stories along the way as we go, you know, making mm-hmm. stories, making these seeds part of our story, and hopefully part of our, you know, children's story and other people's children's story, making, you know, the first time people often remember the first time they planted a garden when they were a child, and they oftentimes remember the first thing they grew. You know, it's mm-hmm. one of those things that they connect with oftentimes yeah. with grandma or aunt or uncle or whoever it was. It's a kind of a bonding experience, not only with nature, but also with, you know, family members and sometimes extended family members. It kind of brings people together.
I'm Jennifer Jewell, and this is Cultivating Place. We'll be back after a break to hear more from Jerry Gettle about his work at the helm of Baker Creek Seeds and the fun of the upcoming National Heirloom Expo in Santa Rosa. Stay with us. It's September, and we're back, refueled and excited for the fall season arriving. Have I told you recently how much I enjoy knowing you're out there listening and often touching base with me through comments and emails, Instagram and Facebook? Hello to you all, and thank you for listening and interacting with us, me and Sarah over here. In our downtime, our thinking and germinating time, we've worked on a couple of series over these next 2 months, and I will be really interested in your feedback. What do you think about a series? Good? Bad? Indifferent? I kind of like the focus on one thing for longer than one episode, but maybe it gets to be too much. I don't know. If you register a response, please send it along. I'd love to hear, and you know how to reach me. Okay, now back to our conversation with Jerry Gettle and soon Michaela Cawley and Kaylin Redwood. I would love to explore a little bit your thoughts on the issues and the pressures of things such as Monsanto's Roundup Ready plants and other genetically modified seed in our system.
Yeah, definitely that's an issue, you know, for us and pretty much anybody saving seeds. It's there's multiple different factors. You know, there's the factor of just losing the traditional varieties from, you know, the globalization of our agriculture. That's just overall. But there's many different aspects, like whether these varieties are healthy, for one, and whether they're safe for the environment, for two. Mm. But as far as seed savers and seed companies like us are affected, and home gardeners even that are saving their seed, you really have a hard time knowing unless you test each crop of corn in particular. That's the one that cross-pollinates the easiest because it's wind-pollinated. Mm-hmm. Unless you test each crop, you really have no way of knowing if your neighbor who may be farming GMO corn down the road or down the street somewhere, you don't know for sure if that pollen didn't get into your crop.
Yeah.
And if it did, then you have lost your genetic integrity of your crop. You also, potentially, if it was a bad enough cross, you could be liable for, you know, saving patented genes. Mm-hmm. And also, long term, if everything gets contaminated, we could lose a lot of the old varieties. And that's why it's important that people are saving these old varieties all over. And also looking for, like us in our case, we're always looking for farmers who are in isolated areas where normally they don't grow corn, and try to make it work. It's It works for us, but it takes a lot of extra effort. And then we test every batch that comes through. And it's a, you know, a huge financial outlay. And also when there is, you know, contamination, it's a, you know, a big cost for everybody involved.
Yeah.
So it's fortunately we've gotten better and better at it. But, you know, in the early years, as much as 50% of our crops would get contaminated each year.
And
it's gotten less and less, fortunately. We've just been able to find farmers that are farther and farther from normal corn country, figuring out ways to isolate it by time and distance.
Yeah.
And other factors, you know, and we're able to keep our corn crops pretty much 100% pure now. I think actually if we are going to sell anything, it has to be 100% according to our tests. So.
Yeah. And you mentioned the concept of seed patents. Talk about where Baker Creek stands on that.
We're definitely against, you know, patenting of life in general. You know, we really don't think, and the patents, you know, the problem is the patents are getting more and more invasive and stricter. And oftentimes, you know, these companies basically just, you know, find something, they, you know, find something from a native, you know, a native seed somewhere, they cross it with something they have and you can get a patent on it. And in some cases, they just elect it for a couple of years, call it theirs and patent it if they can get a patent. And, you know, patents aren't given out for just everything, but, you know, if they can convince them that it's unique, oftentimes the patent office doesn't know if that variety maybe even already exists, because a lot of these old varieties, or if you went to, say, Japan and collected something, you know, they might not even be able to prove that that seed already existed and it could already get a patent. But in general, you know, patents are just about basically controlling our food supply, keeping the farmer, you know, from saving their own seed and keeping you buying from the corporation. And that's, I mean, it does have some financial benefits if it's a, you know, a popular crop like corn and soybeans. But on the other hand, you know, it takes away our, you know, our seed sovereignty and our, you know, security. The biggest thing is, you know, it takes away the security. If farmers aren't used to saving their seed anymore, if a seed company goes out of business, then, you know, maybe 30% or 40% of the seed supply or 50% of the seed supply is instantly gone. So it's, you know, taking away, it's definitely, people are losing their, farmers are losing their ability to save seed through, you know, hybridization and, you know, other techniques, and also, you know, just the patenting of seeds. And also farmers have just gotten used to the process over the many years. And oftentimes farmers, you know, it's simpler just to buy it, you know, and that's the risky area that we are in right now.
Yeah. How did you get from the Boise Valley to Missouri, by the way?
My folks moved to Montana when I was about 12, or actually when I was about 5, and then they moved from Montana to here in Missouri when I was about, when I was about 12 or 13. So, and then I've been in Missouri for 20 some years now. So.
And then that leads me to the question, how did you get to California for beginning a seed store and seed bank here and helping to co-found the Heirloom Exposition 8 years ago?
Yeah, it's basically probably about 10 or 12 years ago, or right after we got married, me and my wife got married, it was 12 years ago. Maybe even before we got married, we started talking about, I know I definitely had thoughts of, you know, I've been to California multiple times. I have family on the West Coast, not a whole lot in California, but some. So I'd been traveled to California. I always loved warm climates in the winter. So I thought, man, it'd be nice to have a store out on the West Coast, you know, be able to go out there some for the winter. That was their initial thoughts. And then we got out there, you know, we traveled up the coast from San Diego. And by the time we got to Petaluma, we were, you know, we thought we found the home we wanted there in Petaluma. We loved the town. We loved the area, the counties around there. And it's just been really good. And then a year or two later, we thought, well, why don't we, you know, we got talking at actually at an event in New York and talking to some people that were, we were at an event actually at Sotheby's in New York. It was a charity auction, and got talking about, wouldn't it be fun to do an old time agricultural exposition like they did in the 1800s, where we could display all these different produce varieties. And we were talking about where we should do it, Hudson Valley or in New York, or you know, somewhere in Pennsylvania in Amish country. Or, and then, you know, they said, you know, some of the people that were there said, why don't we, you guys are already out in Sonoma County. That was one of the areas, you know, that would, why don't we try it out there? And that's kind of, it just kind of started from just kind of that discussion. It was basically started because we wanted to do an exposition of produce where people could come see, touch, taste.
Yeah.
And learn about, you know, meet the people that grew it. And, you know, initially the first thought was doing something maybe in Times Square or something in like Hudson Valley. That was kind of the original thought a year or so before maybe we actually started the Heirloom Expo.
Yeah. And now it's going to be 8 years old, and it's this fantastic just celebration for 3 days of vendors and displayers and growers and food people and color and the biggest pumpkins and the most tomatoes in the world displayed in any one place, I think, is one of the great markers of the exposition. And if you have never been, you should definitely make an effort to get there 1 year, because it really affirms something in you about this human impulse to want to grow and love food, I think.
Yeah, it's definitely connects you more to food and the people that grow food than anything else I've been involved with. It's kind of a celebration. It's kind of like what fairs used to be about, you know, a celebration of the harvest, not just too much today. You know, fairs are about cheap gadgets and rides. Mm-hmm. And fairs originally in this country were agricultural expositions where people were coming together, you know, basically to learn about farming, learn about what other neighbors are growing and share ideas and facts and stories. Mm-hmm. And, you know, taste what people made locally. And that's what it was really all about. And that's what we're trying to take it back to, you know, trying to make it into an event like, you know, would have happened, 100 or 150 years ago, in the fact that it's showcasing the harvest, and then also bringing it up to date, talking about what issues we're involved with today, you know. Mm-hmm. and making it on more of a global, you know, sense now than just a fairs traditionally were local, which would be great to have a local fair throughout, you know, a local produce display throughout the U.S. but and globally, but unfortunately, you know, so many of the fairs have dwindled in as far as what people bring to them. People have kind of gotten discouraged and they have busy lives, so we decided to make, you know, and as far as what we can do, one is all we can handle each year. So, but it brings people together from everywhere, and that's what's fun. You know, when I'm there, I meet as many people from far away as I meet from close. You know, it's mm-hmm. just as likely to meet somebody from Ohio as it is to meet somebody from Santa Rosa. So it's, you know, really exciting. You know, every day it's like, you know, I'm meeting people from Korea and Guatemala and Mexico, and, you know, it's amazing the diversity of seed collectors. We get a little bit of people from everywhere, it seems. So it's really fun to, the really serious seed growers and collectors come from a long distance. And then the more hobbyists come, you know, from more local areas. So it's really great to bring all these people together and the school kids and show everybody in three short days, you know, what we can do for our food supply and how we can change it.
Yeah. The aspect of it that is this global think tank, the speakers and the lectures on these, some of these really big issues in our food and our environment and our cultural literacy of the day, I think are so compelling. I think on the current brochure I read, you have something like 140 new speaker topics, and at least one of them, maybe it's the theme for this year, is the Celebrate Global Gardeners, really focusing on this preserving of heritage and avoiding the GMO issue in the seed supply. What are some of the exciting speakers from your perspective that people can look forward to this year?
Oh, it's just it depends on their topic they're interested in. Mm-hmm. But what I think we're really strong on this year is topics along the seed itself and the produce itself. But we also cover homesteading topics, you know, how to survive off the land, how to make money off the land, a lot of that this year. But that's probably the second main theme is, you know, how to actually make a living on your farm or garden. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But then the other main theme this year is, you know, seed saving and preserving the older varieties. Probably the speaker I'm most excited about who's returning again this year is Dr. William Wise Weaver, who's written about, I think, 19 books now. Mm-hmm. And several on heirloom gardening, including the biggest and best known book, The Heirloom Vegetable Gardener. That's probably the best known. It came out actually back in like 96, and he just came out with his updated version, which is better mm-hmm. than ever. But his stories and his history of our food, all of his books deal with food history, whether it's seed saving or cooking, or et cetera. But his stories and his perspective on our food supply is probably the most exciting topic in my mind, but there's a huge host of other speakers that are equally interesting. That's just probably my, you know, favorite. And the main thing I'd like to bring out this year that's different than before, we have about a 40 different, at least 40 different, I might be more than that, but it's might be more like 60. I can't remember the exact number, but we have a lot of roundtable discussions this year. It's at least 40 to 60, somewhere in that neighborhood, where people can sit down in small groups and break out into more separate topics. Like, it might not be like, if you're wanting to learn how to save seed, like hands-on, these individual topics, or if you want to learn how to make pickles, or if you want to learn how to make cheese, or if you want to learn how to grow squash, all these individual topics, you can sit down with an expert and be able to ask questions for an hour. And that way you can get your, not just the lectures, like we have all the same lectures pretty much as we always have had, mm-hmm. where it's for like large groups, but we have a lot of specific topics, whether it's, you know, growing your own cotton and making your own clothes, or, you know, a lot of these specific topics, you know, making kombucha, and on, there's just a whole host of, you know, topics on seed saving or GMO activist or, you know, preparing food in general. So a lot of people, you know, that's the thing, they can listen to a lecture, but they want to get all their questions answered. Mm-hmm. So that's what we're excited about. These roundtable discussions are going to be groups of about 15 to 20 people at each one.
And the entire event is a not-for-profit endeavor, and all of the profits go to school gardens and food programs. I feel as though I would be remiss if I did not mention the incredible work not only the Expo does, but Baker Creek Seeds does as well, to support nonprofit, volunteer, pro bono seed saving and seed education around the world. How did this get started for you, I think, and what is the importance of that for you personally, Jerry?
Well, it's, you know, profit is, you know, it's a hard balance. You got to make profit to make a business run. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, what do we really need? You know, personally, what do we really need? Do we really need three cars? You know, do we really need three houses? I mean, I think in America, people have kind of gotten the concept that, you know, everything, the bigger, the grander, the richer, it's really better, the happier we are. But, you know, these things are really not, are really have nothing to do with making us happy. Mm-hmm. What makes us happy is when we're actually, you know, doing projects we believe in, working with people and for people, you know, as a community. Not saying that, you know, it's bad to make a profit or it's bad to own a nice car, but in my case, I'm not interested in any of that. As far as, I'm interested in making a profit, but I want to, you know, we want to do something with Baker Creek. And I think most of the people that come to the Heirloom Expo want to do something beyond just getting rich. Most of these people are coming because they love farming, and in general, farming doesn't make you rich, but it gives you a wonderful life. It gives you food, and it, in general, you survive on it. And if you do it right, you can do well, and so forth. So I think that's the big overall thing. The Heirloom Expo, they're really, it shouldn't be an event. We didn't feel to make money. It's an event to, it's an event. Hopefully, the small farmers that are coming can make a little money. But the event itself, we don't want anybody taking home money from the Heirloom Expo itself, except people like school garden projects, you know, school kitchen projects, projects that are actually educate the children beyond just the Heirloom Expo. Mm-hmm. For the kids that couldn't come, we want this whole enthusiasm to continue and to go from year to year and continue to grow area schools and school gardens, making them more than just a place to learn about, you know, the mathematics, but also a place to actually connect to the soil and the food they eat.
Mm-hmm. I have read your wife, Emily, and some of her work in terms of making a home and what we consider to be home. And she said something really beautiful about how she was raised by her family, learning to sew, learning to cook, learning to grow, and considering everybody we meet, no matter where they make their home or where you're meeting them, considering them to be home folk to you in some capacity. And I feel like this is really borne out in the work that Baker Creek is continuing to do and to support in this world.
Well, sure, appreciate that. But yeah, it's, you know, me personally, I just, it's just exciting to connect people, get people interested in their food, and get people thinking beyond the politics or whatever else is happening, you know, locally or globally, you know, in all these other areas that might be tragic and so forth. But bringing something that's a little bit, you know, happy and a little bit, you know, something they can do locally themselves on a local basis, whether it's, you know, just helping people get a good, healthy food supply or helping the community, you know, the community food pantry or kitchen or your local school or your local prison. You know, the gardening thing and the Heirloom Expo thing goes far beyond just, you know, people getting healthy food. It's so much. So many of the people that come to the Heirloom Expo are connected to these other groups. And it just continues to, I think, you know, make a better, you know, a better society if people can get away from their screens for a little while and actually connect to the outdoors and connect to each other. You know, it makes society think about, you know, what we're really doing here. You know, are we really here just to make money, go home and watch the TV and get up and you know, do it all over again?
Now, you have four young children?
Four children. We just adopted, well, not just, but about 7-8 months ago, we adopted two children from China. So, and then we have two biological children, and they're range in age from 3 to now 13. So,
okay, so
we're busy with that as well.
So. Yeah, I bet you are. Tell me, give me a visual description of what you are harvesting from the garden and eating at home with those children and Emily this time of year, Jerry.
Oh, it varies because different kids have different things they like to eat. But,
don't they?
Me and Emily, the kids don't like them, but we eat a lot of bitter melon right now. It's a Asian Chinese vegetable. It's really unknown, you know, in America as far as, you know, the general population just doesn't. If you're outside of an Asian household, and even in many Asian households, they don't eat it anymore. But that's one of my favorites. But on any given day, we eat that. We eat, of course, zucchinis and all sorts of squashes, a crop called water spinach, which is not even allowed to be sold in the U.S. because it's invasive potentially in the southern states where it doesn't freeze. Mm. We harvest a lot of that for our personal use. We can't actually sell the seed. But that's a really delicious green. And we're harvesting Asian pears right now, some watermelons. It's on and on. There's probably 50 to 100 different crops throughout the summer that we're harvesting, whether we, you know, different types of basil and herbs and lemongrass. So it's we eat a lot of Asian food. So, you know, probably 60% of what we eat or 70% is, you know, from Asian vegetables in general.
Yeah. Thank you very much for being a guest on the program today, Jerry. Is there anything else you'd like to add about your work with Baker Creek or the upcoming expo?
Well, I just hope to see everybody there, and it's only $15 to get in, so people can come on down. And the nice thing is any money, like you mentioned earlier, is raised. It all goes to the schools. Anything that's raised over and beyond, and a lot of groups make donations as well. So we have, like, different sponsors donating things to help the school garden projects. And then, of course, all the produce at the end of the event, anything that isn't sold to raise money for home or for school garden projects goes and taken home with people. They buy the produce and take it home. Anything that isn't bought and raised funds for the schools actually is donated back to the schools or other, you know, anything prisons, church kitchens, soup kitchens of various sorts that are making food for either the homeless or for schools, et cetera. So the whole thing is kind of intertwined in the community. So if you want to volunteer also, we really encourage anybody, if they have a little extra time, we can definitely use volunteers because so much of this event is, you know, a volunteer organized event.
Great. Thank you very much for being a guest.
Thank you so much.
I'm Jennifer Jewell, and this is Cultivating Place. Having heard the story and mission of Baker Creek Seeds, we're now going to revisit a conversation with the Organic Seed Alliance, a nonprofit that Jerry's work supports and which in turn supports small seed growers and seed advocacy on a national level. As well, we'll hear from one seed grower in Northern California, Kaylin Redwoods of Redwood Seeds. Stay with us. It's Jennifer. I find Jerry Gettle to be a real inspiration and the real deal of a plant lover and seed saver. that he was a member of the Seed Savers Exchange by the age of 16? That's excellent. And the rivers of his Danish and German grandmother and his Mexican grandmother all coursing strongly through his life work, it reminds me how important the early childhood engagement really is. Although it's never too late to become a gardener. We know this as well. I was inoculated early. One of my earliest memories, maybe I've shared this before, but a good story bears repeating. So one of my earliest memories, and maybe I'm 3 years old, is of being underneath the potting table in the greenhouses at Berthoud Greenhouse in Berthoud, Colorado. It would have been 1968. I could not be more than three. My mother had gotten a part-time job at the nursery, and my father was completing his PhD in wildlife biology at Colorado State University in Fort Collins. So my older sister would have just been in kindergarten. I can see the loamy and perlite-studded potting soil all around me. I can smell it. I can hear the sounds of women's voices, smiling, happy, busy women and their chatting, productive voices. It was warm and humid, and to this day, that combination of perfumes and sounds when I enter a healthy greenhouse brings my mother and a deep sense of well-being to me, all in one inhale rush. It's perfect. What about you? Early or late inoculation? The other thing I love in this conversation with Jerry is this almost universal recall so many plants people have of their first seed, right? It's like their first love. Jerry remembers his, Kaylin remembers hers, I remember mine. It was nasturtium seeds. What about yours? What was your first seed? You know I'm gonna want you to share with me, and you know where to share. Send me an email. Send me a voice memo. Leave me a comment on this week's post on Instagram or Facebook. I'll get back to you, and I'd love to share it with other listeners. Okay, now back to our seed stories with Michaela Cawley and Kaylin Redwood.